Welcome to another episode of Warships Pod. And as the United Kingdom strives to maintain a credible strategic deterrent in the face of Russian aggression, including threats from Moscow to go nuclear due to alleged Western interference in the Ukraine war, our guest on this podcast is Dr. David Blagden to consider the case for augmenting the sea-based Trident missile force, the UK's nuclear deterrent. David is an associate professor in international security at the Strategy and Security Institute and in the Department of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Exeter. And relevant to the podcast and what we're discussing today, he wrote an article in the November edition of Warships IFR magazine under the headline UK Nuclear Deterrent to Augment or Not to Augment. So, David, welcome.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
I wonder if we could kick off by asking what exactly, in general terms, is augmentation and why the idea is even worth considering after 56 years of the Royal Navy being the sole provider of the UK national strategic deterrent?
Yeah, I mean, this is a concern that's started to be knocked around a bit in some policy communities and things. Concern of whether UK nuclear posture, as it currently stands, is adequate for the contemporary strategic environment. And of course, you know, the answer may well be yes, it is adequate, but you know, it's still worth thinking about and considering these ideas. So you know, some of the options that are out there would include you know, for example, whether the UK would need a tactical nuclear weapon system again, having not had one since 1998, or some change to kind of declaratory doctrine around potential employment of the Trident missile system. So these are some of the ideas that are being knocked around, both in terms of when we think about the sort of intensity, the renewed intensity of the threat to NATO from Russia. We think about the rise of China in East Asia, and in particular what the rise of China in East Asia is doing to American priorities, you know, the United States potentially being less focused on the defense of Europe because it has this very, very potent peer competitor on the other side of the world.
And then as European NATO powers, is it a case that they need to do more, and that includes the UK?
It could potentially be, yes. Obviously, there are two nuclear powers within European NATO, the UK and France. France still has tactical nuclear options, which the UK does not. And yeah, the part of the discussion here is really whether whether if we were to see a situation of diminishing American commitment, whether that's in terms of the US being preoccupied with elsewhere or simply less willing to do more on Europe's behalf, either way, whether it would then be incumbent, particularly on the UK and France, to try and fill any possible gaps that might exist in the sort of deterrent ladder.
And that when we're talking about UK and France, as they are at the moment, in the UK's sense, the nuclear weapons are solely the responsibility of the Royal Navy to use as a deterrent or to provide the UK with a deterrent, and that's the four Vanguard-class submarines with the Trident missiles. But with France, they have their own nuclear deterrent submarines and also, I believe, an air-launched nuclear deterrent. And so does augmentation mean that the UK needs to look at air-launched and other aspects of broadening and improving the nuclear deterrent value, as it were?
It's one possible consideration, yeah, an air-launched option. Obviously, the F-35 has been designed to be a nuclear-capable aircraft, and the UK will be an F-35 operator. So that is one possible option. Obviously, tactical nuclear weapons have fulfilled various roles in the past, so they might be used in a tactical capacity, which is a bit of a misnomer because, you know, any use of nuclear weapons is a profound strategic choice. But, you know, that label is applied to mean, you know, they could, for example, be used to stop a column of armor or something like that. So that was some of their sort of Cold War conceptions of their use. Also nuclear depth charges in the naval domain, you know, which takes some of the challenge out of submarine hunting, because you don't need to be quite as accurate if you know broadly where the submarine is and put a nuclear depth charge in the water. But they could also have a role in, for example, retaliation in kind. You know, so if the Russians were to use a sort of small nuclear weapon in a kind of battlefield capacity, the ability to do something at a comparable level, so not having that sort of escalatory gap where you either can't respond at that level or you have to resort to, you know, kind of strategic nuclear apocalypse, which you'd obviously have quite strong reasons not to do as well. So there's that dimension to it, that, you know, giving sort of options to respond in kind and at scale to try and preserve deterrence at all levels. And then there's also, you know, the questions about how nuclear weapons can be used to sort of reassure allies. You know, obviously part of what we've seen in the past during the Cold War was the employment of tactical nuclear weapons from the three nuclear powers to try and reassure non-nuclear NATO allies of the strength of those backers' commitment, try and convince them they didn't need to pursue their own proliferation was a large part of it. So air launch weapons could potentially fit in there. You know, and there's some possible options. You know, one option would be for the UK to join US nuclear sharing as it already exists. There are various NATO air forces that employ American tactical nuclear weapons in the sense that they carry them, so they're still owned by the Americans, still kept under lock and key by American personnel, but deployed with European air forces. You know, one sort of limitation of that approach, right, is that if your concern is about potential diminishing of American commitment, then the UK simply becoming another one of the European states that does that doesn't necessarily change anything. There's already European countries doing that. So that would be a consideration. There's also, you know, when we look at sea-based options, you know, it's kind of in the public domain, you know, according to sort of various sources, that the Trident warhead could be detonated in different states of yield or at different altitudes, things like that. So that warhead could actually potentially be employed in a less, again, it's, you know, the misnomer of calling something non-strategic, given that it would be such a huge strategic choice. But there is ways in which that warhead could be employed, not just in a sort of retaliatory capacity against a massive, you know, seeking a massive yield against some sort of high value target, but instead to be used in a military kind of capacity, say as a bunker busting weapon or, you know, to employment against, say, a specific military installation. So there's things that can be done in that domain. You know, let's say some attack had happened against a British airbase. You know, the Russians had used a tactical nuke against Lossiemouth or something like that. So there's ways that you could use the Trident warhead to deliver similar effects. Obviously, the big problem with that is that if you fire a Trident missile and the Russians or the Chinese or whoever it is detect that launch, you're effectively then sort of hoping they take it on trust and saying, oh, no, trust us, it's just a small retaliation, rather than them seeing a Trident launch and concluding that the end of the world is upon us and retaliating at a truly massive level. So that's the big problem with potential sub-strategic employment of Trident. And indeed, British government did used to talk about Trident having sub-strategic utility back in the 90s. Which was a bit of a sort of a hedge against concern when the WE-177 tactical weapon was retired in 1998 to sort of allay some of those concerns that, oh, we do still have this option to retaliate at different levels of yield. But it seems to have fallen out of being discussed, even though the technical capability is still there, quite possibly because of that sort of escalatory potential that using a submarine-based weapon would bring.
Yeah, I mean, there's in the past, I've had discussions with various people about this idea that was put forward at various times of using nuclear-tipped cruise missiles, the Tomahawk, for example, to be fired from, let's say, an Astute-class submarine or, in those days, Trafalgar-class submarine. But it was pointed out the very thing you've just mentioned, that you launch a Tomahawk with a nuclear warhead on it, and it means that nobody knows if you're actually launching a conventional Tomahawk or a tactical nuclear Tomahawk, and therefore they will, you know, like you said, they'll escalate it and think they maybe that they're being attacked by a nuclear weapon when they're not. And then there's the idea that if you don't use Trident for, let's say, this tactical use, and you try to use Tomahawk, then that means you have to put your submarine in a much smaller area of water to reach the targets in Russia or wherever they are. And of course, a cruise missile can be shot down, whereas it's much harder to shoot down a ballistic missile. So what brings us to actually talking about this, because it seems like we're back in an era of madness, not mutually assured destruction, but, you know, actual madness, where we're looking at the Russians who have invaded Ukraine and are fighting a war there. And the idea of NATO's nuclear weapons, of course, didn't deter the Russians because Ukraine's not in in NATO. So there are those that say that maybe if Ukraine had retained its nuclear weapons, and I'm unclear in my own mind if they ever actually owned their own nuclear weapons, which they allegedly gave up. So we're now in a situation, it seems, two to three years on from the proper big invasion of Ukraine, where it's running a bit unregulated and a bit wild. So are you concerned that there's no kind of interplay between the two players in the new Cold War, if we can call it that, that there was in the old Cold War, where a lot of things were clearly understood?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have some sort of perverse things going on, right, in the sense of, you know, the Russia of today is actually much weaker than the Soviet Union was. But as a consequence of a sort of relative lack of power, leans at least as heavily and quite possibly more heavily on nuclear weapons, right? You know, if we think back to the Cold War, it was NATO that was thought to have conventional inferiority. You know, some debates about, you know, certainly by the 80s, maybe NATO's sort of advances in things like precision targeting and comms and stuff actually meant that the balance was more pro-NATO than a lot of people thought. But generally, there was a concern that NATO was the sort of inferior party there and was having to lean on tactical nuclear weapons to deter, you know, sort of seemingly superior Soviet power in Europe, which is why NATO had never had a no first use doctrine or statement or anything like that. Whereas now it's the other way round, huge NATO conventional superiority and a much conventionally weaker Russia. With the caveat that it's much conventionally weaker vis-a-vis NATO if the US is part of NATO. You know, if the US were to become a lot less committed to the defense of NATO, then suddenly that conventional balance would not be quite so pro-NATO. But yeah, sort of, you know, within that general paradigm of or sort of situation of NATO conventional superiority, the Russians do lean heavily on nuclear weapons to try and generate deterrence, you know, and they've obviously resorted quite a lot to brinksmanship. You know, obviously you get a bit of a boy who cried wolf effect of, you know, every time you sort of rattle the nuclear saber and then nothing happens. At least some community in your adversary thinks, oh, well, you're a paper tiger. You say this thing, but you don't mean it. But of course, at some point, there would be a Russian red line of whatever that is, where they would resort to nuclear use in exactly the same way that we have red lines at which we think we probably would resort to nuclear use. Now, we hope those lines are quite high. But yeah, I mean, we've been having this debate for sort of 2 or 3 years now about, you know, just how existential or just how high are the stakes that, you know, the Kremlin has convinced itself it has in the Ukraine war. Would it resort to nuclear employment if it thought that, you know, that was the only way to bring about a favorable outcome in the war, or indeed if it thought NATO was getting more involved and sort of wanted to try and make NATO back off, which would obviously be a hugely risky thing for them to try and do. But you know, they have shown that they're not sort of averse to risky escalatory choices. So yeah, we are living in quite a sort of quite a concerning time on that front. Obviously, you made the point that NATO's nuclear weapons haven't deterred, but then in the sense of Ukraine wasn't in NATO, so we probably wouldn't expect them to, right? You know, the whole point of making NATO such a formidable alliance and such a sort of having such a potent deterrent effect of its own is that, you know, it it is very credibly committed to defending what is in it, which necessarily entails, you know, being less committed to defending things that aren't in it. Otherwise, you know, if you were equally committed to defending non-members, there'd be no point in having NATO. At the same time, there has been, you know, deterrence has worked really well throughout the war on one level, which is that neither side has felt it could attack the other directly. And by neither side, I mean Russia or NATO. So, you know, the Russians have not felt they could target, say, arms supply depots in places like Poland or Romania or wherever, even though weapons, NATO weapons from there are being poured into Ukraine to kill Russians and thwart their foreign policy. They haven't felt they could target those kind of sites, you know, anywhere within NATO, at least not overtly. Obviously, we're sort of seeing evidence of sabotage and things like that. And by the same token, no, NATO has been deterred from, even though, you know, it is quite strongly committed to Ukraine's defense on one level, you know, views Ukraine as an important partner, even though it's not an actual formal member of the alliance. And even though NATO has great conventional superiority and could do things like gain air control over Ukraine if it wanted to, it's been deterred from doing that because it doesn't want to fight a war with the world's biggest nuclear power. So in that sense, nuclear deterrence has held pretty strongly throughout throughout the conflict. But yeah, we are obviously in a time when that could go wrong. And, you know, we've seen sort of further escalatory measures from both sides just in recent weeks, with things like the employment of long-range conventional NATO-supplied weapons in Russia. Obviously, you know, it, in some ways, the in Russia distinction or not is perhaps a bit overstated. I mean, the Russians think that, for example, Crimea is in Russia. This is one of their whole arguments, right? So the idea that you're doing in other bits of Russia, you know, Kremlin's argument would be we've already been using it in Russia because all these bits of Ukraine that we occupy are Russia. So whether there's anything different about doing it in sort of Russia proper is kind of up for debate. Clearly, the Russians have been keen to create the impression that there is in order to try and deter that employment from happening. But NATO has now gone ahead and done it, or at least will be for 2 months or so until the US gets a new government, whether the US, the new incoming US government, has any different priorities on that front. But yeah, and Russia sort of changed its nuclear doctrine in response. This sort of move to link conventional attacks that it views as existential by a non-nuclear power if they're backed by a nuclear power, trying to create that connection to, you know, the US, the UK and France, trying to get them to not provide that kind of support. Also interesting questions about whether using those weapons, to what extent it makes those backing states actual protagonists. You know, it's sort of not in the public domain or whatever, but, you know, to what extent do those states need to be in the loop in order to do things like targeting or whatever? You know, there's sort of fine-grained distinctions about at what point are you becoming a protagonist or an actual combatant yourself because of the sort of levels of ISTAR support you're providing and things like that. And then, yeah, the question about Ukraine's own nuclear weapons, you know, the ones that it inherited from the Soviet Union and were returned to Russia. You know, in some ways, those weren't sort of a working Ukrainian nuclear arsenal under Ukrainian control. It was, you know, sort of Soviet weapons with, you know, Ukraine didn't have all the necessary sort of technical details to actually operate them or whatever. You know, the flip side of that argument is, well, but plenty of Ukrainians had worked in the Soviet weapons program. So, you know, maybe if they'd hung on to them, it would have been possible to get someone or, you know, have the expertise necessary to kind of reactivate that and turn it into a working deterrent. And, you know, you've seen debates in Ukraine in the last couple of weeks or whatever, sort of Ukrainian think tanks and stuff talking about, you know, could we regenerate a nuclear deterrent to try and make the, either freeze the, you know, at the very least stop Russia taking any more and ideally make Russia back off. But again, that would be quite a hard thing to do, to effectively sort of a crash proliferation program during conditions of being sort of partially occupied and regularly targeted. You know, the Russians would obviously try and target, you know, a sort of a Ukrainian nuclear weapons program if they thought it was going on, and then trying to get involved in some pretty high stakes brinksmanship to sort of coerce Russia into leaving using a sort of rudimentary nuclear arsenal would be quite a big ask for a number of reasons.
But the big dog in this, as you've already suggested, is the USA, and with Trump, President Trump, coming back for a second term, then it's a bit of a race against time, I suppose, or it's, you know, the sand is running out of the egg timer, you know, down into the bottom for the Ukrainians. So do you think we're going to see Trump end a war in on the first day when he enters the White House? Do you think there's going to be such a dramatic change?
I mean, I'm reticent to engage in, you know, hard predictions. I think, yes, you know, one of Trump's political arts.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, he may well derive personal pleasure from it, but certainly one of the keys to his political success has been, you know, unpredictability, you know, keeping both, you know, political allies and political adversaries, you know, off balance.
You have no crystal ball.
Yeah. I mean, it's not true that, I mean, it's true that he can shut off supplies of, you know, American weapons on day one. He could shut off a lot of the supplies of European weapons as well, insofar as they, you know, rely on American support or are sort of, you know, used with permission of the US if they have US components or whatever. He can't make, you know, the Ukrainians stop fighting. He could make the situation much worse for them because they wouldn't have their sort of outside arsenal. And whether the war would then take on a quite different character, you know, perhaps Russia making major conventional, you know, major sort of battlefield gains or whatever, whether the Ukrainians would then resort to kind of insurgency, more those kind of tactics to kind of impose pain on Russia as an occupying force, or you know, potentially sort of sue for peace from a position of from a quite unfavorable position, which would obviously be a very bleak situation for Ukraine to be in, but might conclude it was necessary. I mean, you know, Trump in his sort of first term also did a lot of foreign policy bluster about, you know, sort of ending endless wars and all these kind of sayings, that, and then remained, you know, broadly as engaged in lots of places as he had been. You know, there was remarkable continuity in American grand strategy, you know, so continued to be heavily present in the Middle East, you know, continued to bomb, you know, sort of various you know, sort of armed groups and stuff in the Middle East, you know, actually remained engaged in NATO, you know, sort of broad sort of commitment to American military primacy kind of remained. So whether he would suddenly become this totally different kind of wrecking force, or, you know, totally different sort of change agent this time around, remains to be seen. You know, there's debates about whether he's now better at using Washington or understand how to get things through, get things done in American policy better this time around, whether there'll be fewer checks on his power, you know, now that the Republican Party more closely resembles the sort of cult of Donald Trump. So yeah, there's cases in both directions there. He can't just make Ukraine stop fighting. He could put Ukraine in a situation where it faces really unpalatable choices and chooses to. But yeah.
Well, the thing that's interesting about all this, particularly with regard to Trump and for the UK, is that the Ministry of Defence here is in the process of conducting a strategic defence review, which is being overseen by Lord Robertson, who is regarded as having presided over a pretty good strategic defence review back in the late 90s when New Labour entered power. So there are high hopes that we'll get a common sense adult defence review that does deliver a UK armed forces that will have a future that enables them to meet the growing threats. But of course, Donald Trump is going to be the president in America at the beginning of next year. And so that adds a whole level of uncertainty into the calculation and calibration, surely, of the SDR, as it's called. And then today, when we're recording this podcast, John Healey, the Secretary of State for Defence, got up in House of Commons, I believe, and announced that there would be cuts in the armed forces. And as far as the Navy is concerned, that's the two landing platform docks, Albion and Bulwark, and two wave-class tankers of the Royal Fleet Auxiliary and a Duke-class Type 23 frigate, HMS Northumberland. And all of those vessels are probably inactive. I mean, I'm not sure about how inactive Northumberland is, but Albion and Bulwark are certainly inactive at the moment, have no crews except for skeleton crews to keep them running, turning over. And the wave-class tankers have been laid up. Again, no crews, no money to run them. So Northumberland will be, I think John Healy said she was beyond repair or something like that. So these are five vessels that are going to go that are surely are not surprising if you had to cut the Royal Navy back to save some money. But the thing that occurs to me and worries me is that this is a bit of a bitter spoonful of medicine to assist the Ministry of Defence in meeting the Chancellor's need for savings. But when we get the announcement of the results of the SDR in March next year, will we get more bitter medicine, or are we going to have a shiny new dawn where the SDR is ideally configured to grow, to boost the UK armed forces and also improve their capabilities, etc.? What do you think, David? How do you think it's going?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any particular insights into how it's going. You know, I know sort of that there's been the, you know, the consultation phase has finished and, you know, sort of services have put in their pitches and stuff, being run in quite an unusual way, effectively kind of outsourced to these three reviewers who have themselves then appointed some sort of subordinates. You know, it's quite an interesting idea, this notion that, you know, that there's no more profound political choice than, you know, national defence, you know, sort of allocation of resources to, you know, between kind of domestic goods and kind of external protection, as it were. So the choice to effectively kind of outsource it is quite an interesting political one. You know, whether that ultimately means it's politically helpful as cover for cuts, because, you know, the government can sort of point at them and say, you know, it's not our doing, it's just these outside experts said that this is what should be got rid of. But obviously the government is the one that will have created or, you know, granted the fiscal parameters in which the SDR has to operate. You're absolutely right that when this review set off running, there was not perhaps a change in government in the US, or at least change in party, because obviously either way it was going to be a different individual. But an American administration that is much more sceptical about commitment to European defence was perhaps not either expected or at least not hoped for. So those fiscal parameters that the sort of Treasury will have granted and will be granting, it'd be interesting to see whether there is any sort of political change or direction that sort of fiscal envelope has to be expanded. You know, obviously, they've already, the recent budget was itself fairly sort of expansionary on a number of sort of domestic fiscal fronts, you know, with sort of a decent rationale behind it, the idea that there'd been sort of, you know, both public services, infrastructure, things like that being systematically underinvested in, which is sort of hampering productivity, hampering growth, you know, and all these things are probably true. But it does mean that the fiscal envelope for defence is pretty tight. I mean, obviously, it's always pretty tight. We could have been doing this podcast at any point, you know, the last 70 years, the last 30 years, you know, the last 15 years, whatever time frame you want, and we'd all be saying, oh, you know, resources for defence very tight, you know, cuts, you know, that's just one of the uncomfortable things about being a sort of declining major power. You know, perhaps if we get, you know, a big shot of productivity or whatever out of more, you know, infrastructure spending, then there'll be somewhat less relative economic decline. And ultimately, then when we talk about 2.5% or 2.2% or whatever amount of percent it is, then, you know, at least in principle, hopefully one day the total economic output that is a percentage of will itself become bigger, so that that percentage number buys you more. You know, that would be a nice place to end up in. But yeah, I think your basic thrust of your question is right, that on the one hand, we've got a very bleak and probably worsening external security environment. You know, this is now a sort of an additionally internationalized war now that an Asian power has got involved, right, now that there are North Korean troops fighting as well. The extent to which the sort of Russian war effort is underwritten by some Chinese backing, you know, clearly NATO kind of sinking power into Eastern Europe suits China really well. You know, the more sort of surface-to-air missiles or attackums or anything like that that the Americans expend in Ukraine suits China really well. So that's a sort of really bleak outlook, plus an American administration that is going to be much less committed to European defense. So there's lots of things in the negative column, but then you flip it around and look at the fiscal side, and you know what? There's no appetite for any less of anything domestically. No one wants to pay higher taxes, you know, and the government boxed themselves into, you know, on the election campaign that they weren't going to raise major taxes, you know, already a very high level of taxation. No one wants a worse NHS. No one wants roads to get even more potholed. You know, no one wants their children's school to collapse, you know, so there's not loads of leeway. But, you know, as we've also seen, you know, whether it's the pandemic or the global financial crisis or whatever, you know, when an emergency suddenly arises, then, you know, you can turn on the tap when it comes to money pretty dramatically. You know, you can suddenly, having said it was simply impossible to find another £2 billion, suddenly, you know, you can make £200 billion available. So if there were to be some really dramatic shock, you know, if NATO were suddenly to be at war with Russia or whatever, then you probably would see, you know, a big turning on of the tap when it came to defence in a quite sort of remarkable way that hasn't been seen for many decades. But at the moment, it's hard to be especially optimistic. I think you're right in your sort of setup of your point that those five ships, four of them had effectively been scrapped anyway by the last government. They just didn't want to bear the political costs of actually announcing as such, so they just kept them in, you know, this sort of zombie state of extended readiness, but they weren't going anywhere anytime soon. Northumberland's perhaps slightly different, sort of going through her refit and then sort of found to be much more sort of broken structurally than anyone had realized, and that the refit would have effectively become a total rebuild, so just no point doing that to a kind of pretty old tired ship anyway. But the fact that does then produce, you know, a yet another cut in the escort fleet is then an indictment of the fact that we've built so few escorts so slowly, right? You know, we should have had more frigates, you know, potentially, and you know, more destroyers as well, but certainly more frigates, whatever kind of escort, coming through much more quickly and sooner, to not get to the point where these tired, overworked Type 23s are. Because, you know, it also makes you wonder, you know, what are all the rest broken too? You know, what other ones might be hiding some, you know, profound structural problems or whatever? They've all been worked past their intended lifespan, and they've all been worked much harder than they were supposed to be worked. So that's really concerning on that front. But yeah, it's effectively with four of these five announced today, it's really just a confirmation of what everyone already knew, that they were done. But at the same time, it is a much broader indictment of sort of failure of the shipbuilding pipeline, underinvestment in the Navy specifically, defence more generally, which has allowed us to get to the point where we now face this really bleak strategic environment, and the cupboard is so bare, right? You know, sort of, and part of it is the legacy of the Iraq and Afghan wars and things like that, and you know, the sort of fixation on sort of counterinsurgency and sort of expeditionary interventions and these kind of things that have, you know, led to forces better configured for deterring and fighting major war, you know, in Europe, now that we have that kind of threat again, having been run down quite as deeply as they have been.
Yeah, I mean, the frigate building gap was 16 years where no new frigates were built. And then the Type 26 comes along, and that takes an age to get started. And the Type 31 was a bit quicker to get out of the blocks. But now it strikes me that the main battle that we face is time. The time potentially is running out, and you cannot just whistle up a navy or the people to operate ships, aircraft, whatever, submarines. It takes years and years and years. And that's the thing that really concerns me. Not the five ships identified, but the fact that now we, as you say, the cupboard is bare. And if they think that, if let's say Russia went to war with NATO, that there would be any time at all to rebuild our military, then they're deluded, because there wouldn't be. It's the lifeboat party. You go in what you're dressed in, and we're not dressed in very much. But it strikes me that the money, I'm getting my crystal ball out now, and I think that the money and the people, because recruitment needs to be sorted out as a priority, will go to the submarine service, which is under extreme pressure. We know about the Vanguard class submarines, the Trident missile submarines that have been doing very, very long patrols, and not enough attack submarines out there as well. The carrier force, which although some, maybe people in the army, are trying to get scrapped if they can, if you believe the news headlines, they don't like them, but I think they'll stay. The F-35, there'll be drones. The new frigates, of course, and the Type 45 destroyers need sorting out with their power plant, and everything needs a boost in firepower. And what RFAs, Royal Fleet Auxiliary Support Vessels, remain, need to be out there doing their business. So, you know, I would think that's where it's going to go. The Royal Marines, of course, will be maintained. There are still four vessels that could carry the Royal Marines on various missions. Whether they'll get these new vessels that John Healy mentioned today, I think, I don't know. I mean, they're years away. It's a bit like the frigates taking forever to enter service. So I think it's a case again, probably now and after SDR, of jam tomorrow and gruel today. But there are new dangers out there. So in summing up, do you think the UK is in danger, especially if America goes, and NATO in general, of being exactly in the same situation as Russia, where the nukes become first choice, not last choice?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real concern that has been around for a while, that the UK, and France too, but probably the UK even more, has ended up in this very weird situation of having pretty small specialists, you know, highly competent and highly trained, and having some really good pockets of expertise, you know, but really quite small and diminished armed forces that, or conventional forces that aren't really capable of warfare at a sort of major state kind of scale. You know, whether that's sort of ground forces and, you know, sort of not effectively really being able to sort of do divisional scale stuff, or, you know, sort of maybe being able to cobble together one division or whatever, or whether it is sort of, you know, that we can assemble a carrier group, providing we pull, you know, sort of every seagoing escort off every other possible task, or, you know, combined with also having a strategic nuclear arsenal, you know, the sort of atomic firepower to end the world sort of thing, or at least provoke others into retaliating in a way that would mean there was probably not much world left. It was a problem already that sort of scholars and stuff had pointed to, and it's now becoming more sort of, you know, pressing as a policy concern as well. I think you're right, you know, with, you know, we look at all the things that are under pressure in the UK conventional forces, that even if some more money is made available, you know, it will be very quickly swallowed, right? You know, sort of getting to 2.5% of GDP or whatever, you know, especially as long as growth remains anemic and therefore GDP itself, you know, is not expanding all that much, then really that would just be sort of, you know, fulfilling, patching up, you know, lightly enhancing the existing force, not some sort of sudden era of, you know, sort of milk and honey for the Navy or defence or anything like that. There clearly is stuff that could, you know, obviously this sort of idea of lethality has become a bit of a sort of defence, you know, buzzword bingo. But certainly a sort of sense that's been around for a while, you know, I think it was the House of Commons Defence Committee in the last Parliament, or maybe even the Parliament before that, sort of, you know, said that, likened the Royal Navy to sort of well-defended herbivores, right? You know, so kind of good sort of missile defences and things like that, but not actually a whole lot of offensive firepower. So there might be things that can be done for modest amounts. You know, I think there's just been the news about Spear 3, you know, the sort of cruise missile, making further progress on integration in, it was being tested somewhere in Scandinavia. And so, you know, potentially getting back to the point where are sort of fast jets. Both the carrier-borne ones and the land-based ones have standoff weaponry that can kill ships and things like that. Whether, you know, the addition of naval strike missile to the frigates and destroyers, we do still have, so they have some sort of anti-ship and land attack capabilities. So there's, you know, within the parameters of the existing force, there's modest augmentations that could be made. You know, whether you think about trying to use the River class as some sort of you know, sort of low-end ASW picket corvette type thing. You know, again, you know, I know France certainly trialed a sort of bolt-on towed array systems with its offshore patrol vessels. So whether we do sort of anything in that kind of vein to try and eke a bit more capacity out of the force as it exists. But I think you're right that, you know, there's so many things that are creaking, you know, following sort of years of trying to basically have a much more ambitious footprint and posture and foreign policy than we've been making military resources available for, means that even if there is more money, you know, it's really just going to be sort of trying to sustain the existing force. And you're absolutely right, that concern about having a strategic nuclear arsenal and really quite modest conventional forces, and whether that forces you into more reliance on nuclear deterrence than might perhaps be prudent. You know, if you think about sort of a Baltic state type Article 5 scenario in NATO, especially if the US was preoccupied with China in Asia or just less bothered about European defense, you know, what that would then look like. You know, if you can't stop the Russians before they've actually pulled off a fait accompli in the sort of Baltic states or whatever, then you're into a sort of really miserable world of choices, whether that's kind of, you know, trying to sort of fight to regain territory with, you know, against dug-in defenses, which, as we've seen in Ukraine, you know, trying to fight through dug-in defenses is really miserable. Whether it's sort of basically conceding that NATO is broken and done because you're not going to do anything about it, or whether you sort of escalate to nuclear coercion and brinksmanship, which, you know, NATO does have the power to do, but to get you into a really dangerous territory in terms of how sort of nuclear escalation can unfold. So yeah, not having such sort of denuded conventional forces plus a nuclear arsenal is quite a risky place to be in a number of ways.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see where it goes, the defence review in March. And fingers crossed, it pulls a few rabbits out of the hat. But anyway, David, that's been a really good discussion and great having you on as ever. And we'll have to see about getting you back after the defence review has been unveiled. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And for more on UK defence cuts and also the naval impact of the Trump comeback, along with a big interview with the head of the Pakistan Navy and news on the Ukraine war and lots more around the world, please check out the January 2025 edition of Warships IFR magazine, which is going to hit the streets and go global on December the 20th. Connect with us via social media on X and Facebook, and in both cases that's at Warships IFR. And you can also find us on YouTube at Warships IFR TV. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your podcast app. Keep your eye on the horizon for our next episode.